regardless of what you have been through, there is someone somewhere that is feeling stuck because they've been through something similar, and they're just waiting for you to be the messenger to say that you can overcome it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Praise Arrow podcast. My guest today is Leah M. Forney. She is an 8-times published author, an award-winning transformative speaker, visibility activator and cultivator, as well as a sexual assault thriver and advocate. She's also host of the internationally recognized and syndicated podcast, Hey Queen, Thrive. She is the founder of Purposely Faithful LLC, where she coaches, trains, and mentors women entrepreneurs on how to attract more media, increase their profits, and build their authority in their industry. Now, there's a lot more that Leah does and so many inspiring aspects to her story, but I'm just going to leave her to tell us all about it. Hey, Leah, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Praise. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So like I said, you have so many amazing things that you do, and your story is so inspiring. From the first time I spoke with you, I was just like, wow, you're an amazing person. So I think we can just start off with telling the audience about how you came to be a writer, what it was like for you growing up. So you grew up in Queens, right? What was it like growing up in Queens?
Yeah, so I love to tell this part of the story because I tell people I'm the daughter of two addicts, right? So my mom and dad both battled with addiction. My mom battled with drug addiction. My father was an alcoholic and he was incarcerated. So writing for me as a young girl was like that way of escape. Never thought I would be an author though, let alone write 8 books. But I really took to writing as a young girl to kind of escape the realities of what I was dealing with, you know, because I wasn't raised with my parents and I was raised with my maternal grandparents and my aunt. You know, I felt like the odd girl out, you know, amongst my friends. All my friends had mom and dad at home, and I was coming home to grandma, grandpa, and auntie, right? So I knew that I was different. I felt different. You know, a lot of times my friends would ask me questions about my parents, and because I didn't really have any answers, because growing up, my grandmother kind of sheltered me from what was really happening with my parents, I just came up with an elaborate story. So, you know, when people would ask me about my dad or about my mom, I would always say, oh, they're like secret agents for the CIA, you know, on a top secret mission somewhere. Like, that was just kind of my way of escape. And so young girl Leah always walked around with a notebook and a pen, and I was always writing something, whether it was a short story, whether it was poetry, whether it was a letter to Santa. Like, I was always writing something. And so writing was that way of escape for me. It was the way to not really have to deal with the fact that my parents weren't around, that I was feeling abandoned, that I was feeling rejected, you know, not knowing if I would ever see them, not really knowing all the story, because again, I was being sheltered as a little kid. And so I would say the author version of me came years later, probably around 2015, 2016, God revealed to me that I needed to write a book. And at first I was like, write a book about what? One, and then write a book for who, right? And mm-hmm. He was just like, your life. And I'm like, yeah, that's a lot of parts of my life. So you got to be a little more specific, Lord. Like, what are we talking about? And so he was like, I want you to write a story about your relationship with your mom. And at first I was like, absolutely not. But one of the things about me, I'm very obedient to the move of God. And so at some point I surrendered and was like, okay, fine, we can go down this journey. And so I wrote my first book, Unapologetically Me, Living, Owning, and Walking in Your Truth. I released it April 1st, 2017. And it's literally the story of my love-hate relationship with my mother. So as I grew up, I started to get more insight about my mom's addiction. And I started to see her, you know, struggle with her addiction. If she wasn't getting high, she was chasing men. Like, I saw so many things as a young girl that I felt like really scarred me and really like damaged me. And so when I wrote that book, I really talked about the inward struggle that I had with loving the person that gave me life, but really hating her all at the same time because of her issues and her challenges. And so that book really talks about one particular year in my life where my mom got really sick and I got a phone call from a hospital in New York City. And they were like, you need to come get your mother or she's going to end up dead. And so the little girl in me is like, oh my God, I got to go rescue my mom. Right. So I literally overnight get on the road, go to New York City, pick my mom up, bring her to where I was at the time, which was North Carolina. And my mom was like beat up, Praise. Like, I mean, I was holding back tears when I saw my mother. And so I remember on that drive back to my home in North Carolina, I'm like, okay, God, what am I supposed to do? Like, what am I supposed to do? I've never had to care for this woman. She never cared for me. Like, what am I supposed to do? And in that 1 year, like, so many of that bottled up emotions and feelings that I had as a young girl just came to the surface. Like, it was almost like, and I talk about in the book, like, it was almost like God held up a mirror to me and he was showing me like, hey, if you don't deal with this, 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 and this, right? Like, you can easily spiral down that same path as your mother. And so it was the first time in that year that I really had to start healing. And I really had to start having some really courageous conversations with my mom. And I really had to get to the truth of like what happened, like why all of a sudden you just didn't want to be there. And in that year, I found out that my mom had experienced her own molestation and that she turned to drugs because of it. And what was so significant about that moment was that maybe a year and a half prior to her coming, I had been sexually assaulted. So me and my mom went through something so similar, only she, you know, she went down a different path than me. And so I remember in that conversation, me saying to her, you know, mom, I was I was sexually assaulted as well. And she just cried because her thing was, I wanted to protect my daughters. And I remember telling her, I said, well, mom, how could you give me protection when nobody protected you? Like, you don't even know what that even looks like because you've never been protected. And so it was that moment that I really began to become intentional about healing the mother wound and realizing that my mom was just another human being, another woman, you know, really trying to live life, really trying to navigate life with the lack of tools and guidance and nurturing that she had, you know, and she made some choices that she wasn't proud of. And so that was how the author version of me came to play, because God just allowed me to use personal experiences to show so many other women like me that, yes, we've gone through some like traumatic experiences, but that's not how the story ends.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. And I like how your faith is so grounded and how it has helped you come so far. So I want to hear a little bit more about when exactly you came to build this sort of strong faith. Was it because of your grandma? And how did it help you go down a different path from your mom? So after you faced that sexual assault, why didn't you choose to just, you know, resort to drugs or, you know, find something to numb the pain and all of that?
Yeah, so I definitely have to give my grandmother credit for instilling Christ in my life from a very young age. She would take me and my siblings to church every Sunday. She would, you know, talk to us about God. We would have Bible studies at home. And honestly, I didn't really understand who he was until I was a 19-year-old girl, 19-year-old young woman. And at 19, I ended up in a domestic violence relationship. And I remember prior to me meeting this guy and getting into that relationship, my grandmother sat me down and she was like, okay, you're 17, 18 years old now. I'm not going to force you to go to church anymore. Like, he now has to become your God. Like, you're going to have to get to know God for yourself. And so I did what most 17, 18 year olds do. Like, what? You give me freedom? I'm out. Like, I'm going to go live my life. Right. And so that's what I did. I was like, no church for me. Like, I went and lived my life. And then I met a guy and me and him had similar traumas. Like, his dad was a drug addict, his mom died from drug overdose. Like, we had this trauma that bonded us, and it was just like, oh my God, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Right now I know how codependent and toxic that was, but at 19 years old, I just thought I met the love of my life. And so I got into this relationship with this guy. I mean, he was literally probably every red flag you could think of. But again, looking for love in all the wrong places, trying to find someone that loves me and find some type of security. So when I got with him, he started having a drinking problem. And from there, like, he became really abusive. And so the very last night that he decided to like come home, I mean, drunk. Like, we had moved in together and everything. He came home drunk out of his mind. He's tearing up the house, like calling me everything but a child of God. I remember barricading myself into the bedroom that we had. And I said, God, I don't even know if you hear me. Like, I don't even know if this is going to get higher than the ceiling right now. But if you get me out of this situation, I promise you, I will live my life serving you. That was literally my prayer. Fell asleep, woke up the very next morning, and he was like, the guy was like, get out. And I knew in that moment, God heard me. Like, knew right then. I was like, okay, say less. Grab my stuff. I'm out. And I was out. And from that moment, I literally did every day by day to hold up that end of the bargain, because I knew then that even though I had stopped going to church, even though me and God wasn't really talking like that, I was out here doing me, like he never forgot me. And he was just waiting on me to come back to him. And so from that moment, I continued to just go to church and read the word and really hone in on my faith. And so even when I got sexually assaulted, I'll tell you, I tried to do the drinking thing. I tried to numb it with alcohol. I mean, vodka was my friend. And even that, he wouldn't even let me go that far, because God was like, we're not doing that. We're not going back to what you used to do. And so what I had to do in my sexual assault was I had to just get help and go to therapy and really start to heal from that part of my journey. And I had to rely on my faith, because it was the most difficult traumatic experience in my life. And I struggled a lot with even just wanting to feel beautiful, wanting to feel love. You know, my therapist, I could recall so many sessions where I used to come there with like sweatpants and a hoodie on. And she would try to encourage me, like, Leah, it's okay to look cute again and beautiful and go get your hair done and go get your nails done. But for me, I was like, how about I just don't look attractive? Because if I don't look attractive, then I'm not going to like attract a perpetrator. And so I had to like really go through this recovery process of learning to fall back in love with myself, learning to fall back in love with my body. And so it took therapy and it took God. Like, it literally took me every day just asking God to help me, like help me through this, because I want to be the woman that you called me and created me to be. But this trauma that I'm experiencing right now has me like in a chokehold and I don't know how to get out of it. And so, yeah, I always tell people, I give credit to my grandparents, because if they had never introduced me to Christ, I don't necessarily know if I would have the faith that I have today.
Yeah. And you, when you talked about how you suddenly didn't want to even look good anymore, I can really understand. No, I don't mean I can understand that on a personal level. I mean, on a theoretical level, I can understand that, because very often when this sort of thing happens, I mean, first there's the fear that, okay, you know, if I look good, I'm going to attract too much attention. And then there's also that feeling of, why do I even deserve to look good? Because internally, you no longer feel like that, you know, pretty young, innocent girl. Yeah. Now it's like there's all these things inside and you identify all those feelings of hurt, guilt, shame with who you are internally. Yeah. It's like, yeah, what's the point of a pretty face and I'm looking good when there's all of these not so nice things inside? So I'm really glad that you were able to come out of that and, you know, even use that experience to inspire people. And then about your mom, so I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. So when you said you talked with your mom and she was like, she really wanted to protect her daughters. By the way, you have six siblings, right?
Yeah.
And how many of them are girls?
Four of us.
Four girls, and then that's... Wait, is there six of you, or it's like you have six siblings?
So it's seven in total.
Okay, yeah. So it's like three guys and four girls. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your mom said she wanted to protect her daughter specifically, and you told her something interesting, that she didn't have the experience of someone protecting her. So it seems like there's this negative feedback loop, or is it positive in this case? So there's this feedback loop that keeps going on. It's like one person lacks protection, and so they do not know what to do in the next generation. Now, I talked with someone last week about fatherhood and the importance of having a father in your life. So I want to know your opinion on that. Your mom, did she have a father and a mother? So maybe you can talk a little bit about the importance of having both a father and a mother in your life and how you think that would have made a difference for you or how it influenced the life of your mom as well.
So my mom and I are very similar. We didn't have our dad, so her father passed away very early on. She had a stepfather, and unfortunately, her stepfather was the one that was molesting her. And so my grandmother, her mom, she didn't really do a great job of protecting, you know. And when I think about just the generation that my grandparents come from, like they come from that generation where like grandma stayed, you know. You know, regardless of how chaotic it was, you know, she stayed. Like she stayed married to my grandfather for over 20 years before she finally left, you know. But that was that generation. Like you just didn't leave. Like divorce was so taboo in our grandparents' generations. It was like there's no such thing as, because for most households, right? Like grandma wasn't the working person, grandpa was, right? So if you leave, how are you going to take care of your kids, you know? And so I understand now, you know, why my grandmother stayed. But so my grandmother didn't do the greatest job as protecting my mom when she was going through that. And even in conversations that I've had with my grandmother, like years later, not her knowing that me and my mom even had that conversation, I've learned that, you know, when my grandmother was younger, someone inappropriately touched her. So it kind of was like a generational curse, if you will, that just kind of got passed down, where it was just because my grandmother, her mom died, and then she hated her father. So there was no real protection. I mean, she had her siblings who stepped in and kind of helped raise her, but then they were getting older and going off and getting married and starting their own family. So she kind of was left to kind of take care of herself. Same with my mother, you know, and then it got passed down to me and my siblings because our dads weren't there. You know, me and all of my siblings, we all have different fathers. Only me and one of my sisters, we have the same dad. So it's kind of been that generational curse, if you will. And so when I had that conversation with my mom, you know, I wanted her to understand, like, while I think her intention was always great to want to be there and protect her children, you can't give what you've never received, right? Like, if you don't know what it feels like to be protected or cared for, like, how can you give it? Like, it's gonna be very hard. And so I really think that fathers are so needed in the household. You know, I got to get to know my dad. So when my dad, at last time I saw him as a kid, I was 9 years old. He went off to prison. And I wasn't raised in my father's side of the family. I didn't actually get to know my father's side of my family until I was about 21. Because my grandmother who raised me, she kind of kept me from that side of the family. And I think a lot of it was just her protection. Like she knew that if I got to know both sides of my family, a lot of stuff was going to come out that she didn't know if, you know, if I was emotionally ready to handle. So it wasn't until I was about 21 years old where I had the conversation with my maternal grandmother, and I'm like, listen, I need to know. Like, I need to know both sides of my family. I need to know what really happened because you trying to protect me, I get it, but it's leaving a hole in my heart because I'm like, there's a part of me missing here. And so I wasn't until my 2021 when I met my daddy's mom. And that's when I began to build the relationship with them. And of course, learn more about my father and his battle with addiction and him being incarcerated. And so when I met my father's side of family, my dad was still in prison. And I started communicating with him via letters until he came home. And then when he came home from prison, I still saw that he was struggling with his addiction. And my father was a very, I always say he liked to throw money at everything because he did. He didn't necessarily know how to connect emotionally, but he'll pass you $100 and tell you like he loves you. Like that was his way of being. And so even when I think about the guy that I was in a relationship with who was abusive, that was him. He didn't know how to like love with action. It was like, here, I put a roof over your head. I love you. Like that was the toxic, you know, thing that they had in common. And so oftentimes when I think about my parents, and one thing that I've always wished as a kid was that I did have both of them. My father, when it came to his addiction, I didn't really see it until I was an adult. because as a young girl, he did his best to, like, if he was, you know, into his addiction or drinking heavily, he just didn't come around. So I didn't necessarily realize that I still had a hole in my heart when it came to my dad's absence until I was in my 20s. And then I started seeing how heavily he drank and how nasty he could become. You know, my father and I stopped speaking maybe a year and a half before he actually died, because it got to the point where his drinking was so much that my dad was cursing me out. You know, I was everything but his daughter. You know, one minute he was calling me princess, next minute he was calling me everything but a child of God. And so in me having to heal and protect myself, you know, it took my spiritual father to really say to me, just because that's your biological dad doesn't mean you have to deal with his abuse. Mm-hmm. Because for me, I just wanted my parents.
So your father, you know, for those who might not be familiar with all these terms, and you mentioned something as well, which you might help the audience define. So you mentioned generational curse and then your spiritual father. I mean, I'm familiar with these terms, but just for the audience. So first, what's a generational curse? And then who's your spiritual father, or who is a spiritual father?
So a generational curse, in my opinion, is any theme or anything harmful that keeps getting passed down generation after generation. So it's something that you see that started with grandma or great grandma, and but it gets worse. So if I take it from a biblical standpoint, like the Bible tells you, it gets worse in every generation. So what may have started with something small when great grandma, by the time it got to grandma, it got a little bit bigger. And then by the time it got to mom, it got bigger. And now it just keeps getting worse. Mm-hmm. And when I say spiritual father, so a spiritual father is a male figure who steps, kind of takes the role of your dad, but from a spiritual place. So he's covering you. He's praying for you. He's your go-to person when you're seeking wisdom or spiritual guidance, along your journey. And so I was blessed to be, you know, have two sets of spiritual parents. God literally blessed me with two sets of spiritual parents. So I have my McNeils, which are my mom and dad, and then I have the Godby family. And those two men, Reverend Joe McNeil and Bishop Ronald Godby, literally made me or helped shape the woman I am today. Mm-hmm. They were so instrumental, especially when it came to healing from my father's wounds, because for a very long time, I was so guarded. You know, my bishop, he used to say to me, he's like, daughter, your heart is like you have the Great Wall of China around it with barbed wires and pit bulls. Like, you're not letting nobody in. And I wasn't. Like, it was like, maybe don't touch me, don't talk to me.
Like, I get that.
For a very long time. And so those men showed me what a father was supposed to look like and be like. You know, even though they had their own biological children, they never made me feel like I wasn't one of them, you know, even to this day. And like, we're not in the same state anymore, but I can call and text them right now and they'll be like, hey, daughter, how's it going? Or I'm proud of you. So I got a lot of the nurturing that I needed from my dad from my spiritual fathers. And they were the ones that really helped me to understand that I can love my dad from a distance, because it's long as he was drinking, as long as he was unhealthy, then all he was going to do was bring that toxicity and all of that energy into my life. And when I was at a point where I'm just trying to heal and I'm trying to get closer to God and I'm trying to figure this thing out for myself, you know, and it took me a while, because again, that little girl in me is like, but that's my daddy, you know, like, I want my dad. But I had to get to the point as the adult, realizing, you know what, dad, I love you, but I can't love you so close anymore, because you have some things you have to work on. And that was hard. It was hard for me to make a decision to walk away from my father, especially because I knew he was still in a vulnerable state for himself. But I also knew that as long as he was drinking, he was no good for himself or anybody else. And me being his firstborn daughter, like, I just couldn't deal with it. And so we stopped speaking. And a year and a half after we stopped speaking is when he transitioned out of this life. And I would probably say that's probably my only real regret that I've ever had in my life, because I choose not to have regrets. But I hated the fact that we weren't on speaking terms by the time he had transitioned.
Yeah. So in summary, you're saying that it's important for kids to have both their fathers and their mothers in their lives. And on your dad's end, so just a quick one, on your dad's end, did you find out about whether or not he had his, you met his mom, but was his father around when he was growing
up? No. So I never got a chance to meet my grandfather on his, my dad's side, because he was murdered. So he was murdered by his best friend. And so my dad never had a dad either. So that's what, when we talk about that generational curse, that's what I mean by it's worse. Until somebody is like, okay, we're going to cut this. We're going to cut this off. We're going to do the work. And so I feel like that was what played a big role in my father's drinking. Because in conversations I had with my Nana, his mom, you know, she told me, like, my dad started drinking way before 21. Like, she would have to hide, you know, liquor in the house. Because, and I realized in conversation that that was probably his way of trying to cope with losing his dad. You know, even though he had a male figure, because my grandmother did, you know, meet a guy and was with, and he helped raise my dad and my uncle until they were like 18, 19 years old. But he never felt like a connection to that man. And so I think that's what started my dad's addiction, was that he also didn't have a dad. So it just kind of, the cycle just kept repeating itself throughout my family.
So that being said, I wanted to get your opinion on this. This is, it just came to mind now. So recently, people seem to glorify single parent homes, you know, like, you know, it's a strong woman raising her kids on her own. She doesn't need a man and that's fine. Or yeah, dads can raise kids on their own. You don't need to have another person or in the family. What's your thought on that?
Honestly, I think that is such a toxic thinking and toxic thought, because one, it takes two to make a kid, right?
Yeah.
But if I take it even from a biblical perspective, like, we need each other, right? Now, I will say this. I think that you have to be careful who you have children with, right?
Yes.
And that is the reason why I tell people all the time, like, if you meet a person and you're thinking this person could possibly be the man or woman you end up with, are you having, and this is just me putting my therapist hat on because that's my background too, professionally, but are you having those really courageous conversations prior to kids and marriage and all of that, right? So are we taking a look into traumas, right? Like, are you having that conversation about with your partner, not only revealing your trauma history, but finding out their trauma history, right? Like, yeah, and how it's impacted the way they look at life, the way they look at relationships. You know, some of my friends used to be like, well, ain't nobody going that deep on the first date. I'm like, okay, maybe not date one, maybe date two. But you should at some point ask their history.
Some people go like 4 years and they don't know anything. I'm like, what have you guys been doing? Eating ice cream?
Like, you should... Right. But you should know your partner's history. Like, for example, with my partner, I know he comes from a family of divorce. Right. So that shapes how he views relationships, how he shows up in relationships. But you should know these things. You should know, you know, about their history, their family history, their upbringing, any traumatic experiences that they've had in their life, because all of that is shaping them. You know, I think we have to stop being so surface in relationships. We got to stop, you know, only wanting to have like the cutesy conversations and really have those courageous conversations and really find out how people are thinking. I'm all for the strong, independent woman, all for it. But I think that we're now seeing that the strong, independent woman just wants to be soft and feminine. Like, yeah, they don't want to be strong and independent all the time. You know, I tell my girlfriends and they laugh at me. I'm like, I play damsel in distress a lot of times in my relationship, because what I've learned is that men love to feel needed. So even though the strong, independent Leah could probably go ahead and put together, you know, the desk that she brought, she's gonna call her man and be like, "Babe, put this desk together," right? Like, because he needs to feel needed. Yes, I could do it, and I've done it, but I don't want to do it. So I think that when we hear conversations about, "Oh, you should be a single mom," nobody wants to be. I don't think there's any.
It's a lot of work. Mother
that has ever woke up and said, "Today I want to be a single mom." Like, I think for most part, they want the partnership. They want someone that's going to do life with them, raise the kid together. Like, nobody wakes up and says, "Today is the day I want to be a single parent," right? But it's realizing that, okay, what didn't work out with my children's father or my children's mother doesn't mean that I still can't have the life I'm desiring or the relationship that I'm desiring. It just might mean I need to now look introspectively at what is it that I need and want now? Mm-hmm. Because what I needed and wanted in my relationship with my children's father or my children's mother may not be what I need now. So what do I need now? And then how do I become it? So one thing that I learned after going through a traumatic experience where I lost my fiance before 5 years ago. I did a lot of introspective work and intentional healing. And when I got to the point where I was ready to date again, my therapist said to me, she said, "Leah, I need you to build a husband." That's what she called it. She was like, "I need you to sit down and I need you to write down a list of everything you want in a partner. At who is he at his core? Not what does he look like physically, but who is he at his core?" And I joked around with her and I was like, "Girl, I'm going to need a whole bottle of wine for this because this is a lot." But when I sat down and I did that list, I had to ask myself, what does Leah need now? Like, with everything that I'm building, with my business, with everything that I have going on, what kind of partner do I need now? And then who do I need to become? Yeah. So that I could attract that a partner, because that's what we'll do. We'll say, "Oh, he has to be 6'5" and he has to have a credit score of 800, but you have a credit score of 450.
What's a credit score? I think I know what it is, but I guess most people outside the U.S. don't know what it is.
So in the U.S., the credit score is basically this beautiful number that lenders of like banks, if you want to get funding and all that good stuff, they look to see how well you manage other funding sources. So like a credit card, for example, and it generates a score anywhere from like zero, meaning you ain't got no credit at all the way to, I think the highest is like 850. And so if you have anywhere from like 620 to 850, you have pretty good credit. So if you have less than that, you kind of have poor credit and you need to work on it. And so I say that because those are things that, like, here in the U.S., that's what some women will say. "Oh, he has to make all this money. He has mm-hmm. to have this big credit score, all this stuff." But you also have to match that.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so that's why I say, what do you need now? But then also, who do you need to become? Because you have to be able to match what it is that you're putting out in the universe or praying to God for with whatever that you say you want.
Yeah. So a few things on that. Great points, by the way. The part about ladies not actually feeling that being a single mom is a good thing. You know, yeah, most people, as at now, most people actually just end up there. You know, you got married maybe and you thought, yeah, this would be forever, but you know, things didn't work out, you find yourself alone. Or maybe someone had a child when they were not planning to, and then, you know, they have to raise that child, and then the father is not in the picture. All these things contribute. But what's happening now is people have taken things that happened unplanned and started pushing it as a sort of idea that should be normalized. Like, I empathize with single moms, and I know that they do a lot. It's a lot of work, and they really try to fit in a lot of shoes, or single dads as well. It's not an easy thing to do. But then we have to also have the understanding that that's not the optimal way for things to be.
Yeah.
But when I talk with a lot of people, they're like, "No, you don't need to have someone, you know." Okay, not that many people. It's not like I'm surrounded by crazy friends, but I mean, some people, I talk with some people and they have that idea that, you know, it's totally fine. And I think it's just painting a lie to people, because it's very difficult. I mean, it's hard enough to raise kids, you know, in a two-parent home, and it's even It's very, very difficult when you're doing it alone, and not just for you, but also for the kids, because like you said, there are roles in a kid's life that are meant to be filled by the mom and roles meant to be filled by the dad. And when that's not there, you find a sort of imbalance, and you can see it in people. No matter how well the parents, like the single parent, tried to raise them, unless they really had very strong models of the opposite gender in their lives that showed them that example, you know, and they were also around families who gave them that example of what they should expect from the other gender, you know, a father figure, a mother figure. You can see the absence of that particular role in their lives, and you can tell, okay, something's missing. And so not everyone is able to overcome the limits set by not having that. And that's why I just wanted to put that out there, especially for young girls growing up. I'm saying for young girls specifically, because a lot of them are being told these days that they don't need men and, you know, men are trash, those sorts of things that are being spread. And when you hear the average teenage girl talk about guys, she just feels it's weird. I'm like, why is this narrative being spread? I know that there have been a lot of terrible guys, and a lot of them maybe grew up in neighborhoods where the examples they saw were not the best, you know. Fathers leaving their kids, and guys who didn't want to take responsibility, who just wanted to, you know, get the girl to bed and didn't care about what came after that. That's true. But, you know, they also need to know that there are a lot of good men out there, a lot of really good men out there. And yeah, that's why, like you said, you have to be very intentional about who you're choosing. So when people are very young, they're just thinking, oh, I want a boyfriend. But you shouldn't be thinking about a boyfriend. In fact, most of those teenage boys, they don't know what they're doing with their lives. To be honest, they haven't got their lives figured out. They don't know their left from their right. They don't know the top from the bottom. And you need to ask yourself, what kind of father do I want for my kids? You know, the guy I'm going after right now, is he going to be a good husband for me? Is he going to be a good husband for who I want to become? And am I going to be a good wife to him? You know, can I respect him? Can I love him? Can I treat him the way he deserves to be treated? And, you know, is he going to treat my kids right? Is he going to be a good father? Does he have what it takes? Is he responsible? Does he understand what it means to be a husband? Because, you know, people get married and they say all these vows, and then it's like 2 months into the wedding, they're like at each other's throats, and it's like, okay, I didn't expect this. And the question is, what did you expect, actually?
Yeah.
You know, sailing off into the sunset, sitting on the beach and sipping coconut milk. Like, what did you expect, really? So I think the responsibility aspect is not talked about enough. Like you said, some people you know don't really talk about those questions that help you understand how responsible a person is, and if they're ready to take on this next step in life. These are really important questions, and it's great that you also talk about them.
And I'll say, I think also you have to be okay with creating the kind of relationship that works for you and your partner, right? Like, you'll hear, like, especially here in the United States, there's all this conversation about, oh, I ain't never going 50-50 with no man. Like, if he can't pay 100% of my, but is that realistic for you, right? Sure. Like my partner and I don't pay, he don't pay 100% of bills. Like, 50-50 works for us, right? So I think that where the toxicity in those narratives come from is that we're creating this false thought process or this false picture that every person you get in a relationship with got 100%, he could pay all the mortgage, he could pay all of this. And that's not necessarily true. Like, you have to create the kind of relationship that works for you and your partner. You know, like, when me and my partner got together a year ago, people thought it was crazy that we didn't tag each other on Facebook or social media. We don't have pictures of me and him together. And like, a lot of my friends was like, oh, I could never be with a man that's hiding me. But is he hiding me to who? Because everybody that's of importance to him, they know.
Yeah.
Like, and vice versa. So we have to stop letting people tell us what our relationship is supposed to look like when we should be creating the kind of relationship that works for us. Like me and my partner were very important. Like, early on, I was like, listen, I went through a whole public relationship, went through a whole public grief. In this relationship, I don't need you tagging me on social media. I don't need no post pictures of, like, don't nobody even know his name. Like, he goes by a whole alias when I'm talking about him on social media. Like, that's like, because I wanted that privacy. And I remember having a conversation with a girlfriend of mine, and I was like, know the difference between privacy and secrecy. There is a difference. Like, you know, when someone's keeping you a secret, versus when somebody's just like, I'm protecting my privacy, because the less people that know about what I got going on, then the less chatter, the less hands, the less everything is in my business. And so we just have to be okay with creating the type of relationship that just works for you.
Yeah, that's true. Especially these days where people expect everything to be on social media. I'm like, before social media, people had a way that they got around relationships, and that didn't involve posting it in the daily newspaper or, you know, sending a boy to cry around every home saying, hey, Leah's in a relationship, you know. Yeah. That didn't happen, and people got around just fine. Yeah, so I get what you mean. And then you mentioned something about losing your fiance. When was that? That was like 5 years ago. So
5 years ago.
You were engaged. And how did you get over that? How have you worked through that?
So that was a journey. I was engaged to be married. I met an amazing guy in 2016. We got together. We were together for 2 years before he passed. And he passed away 5 years ago at the age of 30, just unexpectedly. Like, we were living together. We were renting out his parents' basement. And so his mom and dad and his sister were upstairs. We were downstairs. And I remember I was asleep, and his sister came running downstairs, and she was like, Leah, what happened to Joseph? Like, he's on the bathroom floor. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm startled. So I jump up, I run upstairs, and he's just laying there. And it's crazy because prior to me and Joseph getting together, like, I had a whole professional career in, like, being a nursing assistant. And so I experienced, like, working in hospice and all this stuff. So I kind of knew, like, the telltale signs of, like, someone transitioning. And so I remember, you know, I must have had an out-of-body experience in that moment, but I remember, like, standing, like, leaning over him, and I could feel that his, like, breathing was really labored, like he was getting ready to transition. And out of my mouth, I just said, it's okay to let it go, babe. Like, aww. I think my faith just kicked in, and I was like, it's okay to let go. And I always tell people he waited for me to get there for that moment, because not even 5 minutes later, they had pronounced him dead. So it was like he was just sitting there waiting for me to, like, come to him to say it's okay, and then he let go. And so going through that whole process was so hard, because I tell people all the time, like, I've experienced other deaths, but it's something about experiencing the death of someone you were going to spend the rest of your life with, right? Like, literally the day before he transitioned, we were sitting on the porch, and I had finally got him to agree to do a destination wedding. Right. So this was someone I was planning a life with, planning a future with. And so when he transitioned, you know, I wish I could say I had so much support, but I really didn't. You know, they always say death and, you know, weddings and funerals bring out the worst in people. And they didn't lie. You know, unfortunately, I had to deal with so much chaos with his mom and his sister mainly. They basically tried everything in their power to, like, exclude me from things that were pertaining to him. Like, they didn't let me ride in the family car to his funeral, so I had to get another ride there. They didn't, you know, mention me in the obituary at all. Like, you would think that this was not somebody I spent 2 years of my life with, that they, you know, like, it was hard, because it's one thing to lose somebody you love. It's another thing when, like, family members of that person, you know, begin to show their behind. And so I remember, you know, people were coming up to me after the funeral, and they're like, oh, it could never have been me. Like, I don't know how they did it. And, like, just all that talk. Mm-hmm. And all I could remember was hearing Joseph say, like, bow out gracefully. Like, it's okay. Like, bow out gracefully. And so, yeah, I could have probably showed my behind, because at that point he was gone, you know. But for me, it was like, how do I honor the love that I said that I had for this man if I just show my behind at his funeral? You know what I mean? Like, that's not really honoring him. That's not, it wasn't about how I was feeling in the moment. And so after he, like, after his funeral, ended up moving out of the state of South Carolina, where I was at the time. Which is where he was from. So everybody that I knew in South Carolina were people I met through him. So I didn't have family there. I didn't have friends there. So I knew I just needed to get back to where my support was. And so going through that journey, that transition that of really trying to figure out life after the loss was really, really difficult. And I wish I could say it stopped there. You know, unfortunately, I tell people 2018 to 2019 was like literally the hardest year of my life, because about Joseph died in May of 2018. A few months later, one of my dearest friends, her husband took her life. So she ended up passing away from domestic violence. And then my brother's best friend, who was like another brother to me, he ended up taking his life. He completed suicide. And then my dad died. And then Joseph's father died. So I literally had five deaths in a span of 1 year. And what helped me, or what got me to the point to seek help, was that one night I happened to be driving. And I always tell people, when you're highly emotional, don't ever get behind the wheel of a car. But I happened to be driving and I'm just grieving. I'm crying. I'm having so much like the anxiety. I'm crying so bad to the point I black out. And literally when I black out, what brings me back was that I heard the horn of the other car, and we were literally this close from a head-on collision. And in that moment, God said to me, "Are you ready to deal with it? Because it's now dealing with you." And I was like, "Okay, God, I don't know how to deal with it. Like, this is the first time in my life where I felt like my entire life just fell apart. And I didn't know how to deal with it." And I said, "Okay, one thing I know to do is to go to therapy." So I went to therapy. I actually started going to therapy on Joseph's birthday, which was October 18th. And it was in therapy that I realized that I have been grieving my whole entire life. Like, I always tell people, God used Joseph's death to give me the therapy to really unpack all the other losses in my life, like growing up without my parents and all of that and what that felt like. And so I went to therapy. I was in therapy for a good 4 years, just unpacking. You know, I had made a promise to myself. I was like, all right, I'm going to be intentional about healing. I'm going to be intentional about figuring out what life after loss looks like. How does she want to show up? What does she want? All of that. And so I stayed committed to therapy for 4.5 years. And I highly recommend it, because I feel like between my faith in God, journaling, because I'm a huge journaler, and therapy, I don't think I would have ever made it through that year in my life, because it was rough to have to grieve five people that I was close with that died back to back.
Yeah. So you mentioned three things: your faith in God, therapy, and what was the third one? Journaling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think journaling is pretty much underestimated very often, because for you to write you have to think, and if you're thinking, that means you are very conscious, you're self-aware, you're analyzing what's happening with you, what's happening with your surroundings. And a common phenomenon with grief is that it numbs you, so you're numb to what's happening within you, what's happening around you, and you're going through the motions. But when you start to think, then you have to face those emotions. And when you start to write, you have to put those thoughts and emotions to paper, and you can see them. Okay, this is how I feel. This is what's going on with me. That means you have to face them. So yeah, that's a great point. In therapy, you know, here in Nigeria, it's like people rarely go to therapy. You know, in the US, you hear people often say therapy. Yeah, you know, I need therapy. I'm going to therapy. If someone is always going to therapy here, there's still this sort of, it's easier these days, but usually there's this sort of stigma, will I say, attached to it. Like, okay, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why do you need therapy? You know, why do you need to see a therapist? Is everything okay? Well, I guess part of that is because for a lot of people, they seek counseling first in church.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, there are a lot of people in church, especially some church leaders, who are not trained to be therapists. So, you know, it's like, yeah, your sis or someone you know can give you some advice, but therapy is a totally different thing. And it's also, it's just as dangerous as going to see a poorly trained therapist. They could even make things worse. But when you see a proper therapist, there are methodologies and there are steps that they take. You know, even in church, some churches actually train their staff specifically according to some, you know, well-used methodologies, proven methodologies, while others are just like, okay, here's this really cool person. Go, you know, meet them for advice. Sometimes it works, but other times it's like, not the best idea. So, yeah, therapy is a great thing. And definitely your faith, I really admire how far your faith has brought you and how you've been through so many things, but you've been able to get through all of them. And that being said, let's talk about what you do. I think we should have started talking about this long ago, but yeah, let's talk about what it is you do. And your eighth book is out now, right? So your eighth book is Born to be Unbound. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my eighth book, Born to be Unbound, is really the first book I've ever written from a healing place. So my first seven books were just different memoirs of different experiences that I've had, traumatic experiences. I shared a little bit of like things I've done to overcome in those first seven books. But this book, and Born to be Unbound, really came from the scripture in Isaiah 61, where God really talks about how he's giving you this freedom, like this freedom to be who he's called you to be, that you don't have to be bound by your past, by your baggage, by the traumas you've experienced. And so when he put it on my heart to start writing that book, I was 3.5-4 years into my healing journey. And so I wanted to write a book where I would share it with the people that there is life after, right? Like a lot of times we hear, oh, there's life after loss, there's life after divorce, there's life, but there really is life after. And when you tap into the freedom that God has given you, you get to discover what life after looks like for you. Like you get to discover what it is that you want it to look like. And so I always say going through the death and the traumas that I've experienced, like it changed me. And for a long time, I used to think it changed me for the worse, but it really changed me for the better because I've discovered so much about me that I didn't know exists. You know, I didn't know I was as compassionate as I am. You know, I didn't know that I enjoy, you know, serving other people and giving to other people. And so when God laid it on my heart to write Born to be Unbound, that was the message that I wanted people to get, that despite what you've been through, despite the trauma, the pain, the agony, all that you've experienced, you have an unlimited freedom that God is giving you. And that when you tap into that freedom, you'll begin to discover not only who you are, but who he's called you to really be. And so I released that book about a year ago. And it's probably one of my favorite books. I say that about all my books, but it's probably one of my favorite books because people get to see practical steps that I've taken. So I talk about my therapy journey. I talked about, you know, the journaling. I've talked about meditation and how I still to this day, I will meditate. You know, I talked about you know, tapping into the permission. You know, a lot of times, especially for entrepreneurs and people that aspire to be entrepreneurs, like we wait for other people to validate the vision God has given you. And so one of the chapters in my book is God has already granted you the permission. Like you don't need nobody to say, oh, Praise, go forth and be a podcaster. He already told you to do that. Like you just have to do it, you know? And that's what I talk about, is that we have to get rid of the need for external validation and understand that if God is giving you the vision for something, he's already giving you the permission to go ahead and do it. You just have to go forth and do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the book.
That's beautiful. And I'm going to include a link in the description so people can find your book and, you know, get it, because I'm sure with your story, it's going to be an amazing book. So guys, please go get it.
Thank you.
And I saw something in your bio which interested me. So you said you had spent some time working with law enforcement, so you help train law enforcement. What's that like? Seems interesting.
Ah, good old law enforcement. So yeah, so my sexual assault, I always say I'm a sexual assault thriver turned advocate and advocate and activist. So I got into that about a year ago. I was sexually assaulted in 2013. And when I got sexually assaulted at the time, you know, I did all the things that I was supposed to do, you know, contact law enforcement, report it. I did a rape kit. So you would think that, you know, if you do your part, right, the system that is designed to protect and serve and do all those things, they'll do their part. Well, unfortunately, law enforcement didn't do their part. So I became, and I say, you know, I became another Black girl that they kind of put on the shelf. It was like, all right, we got our kit, whatever, and keep it moving. And so June of 2022, the same law enforcement that basically failed me the first time, they called me. And I'm sitting here like, why am I getting a phone call from this police department? And they called me to basically tell me that they finally tested my rape kit 9 years later. They finally tested my rape kit. They had his DNA match. And they wanted to know, what did I want to do about it? And I'm sitting here like, what do you mean, what do I want to do about it? Like, you know, I was just kind of like taken aback. And I remember, again, always relying on my faith in my relationship with God. I remember praying and I said, okay, God, here it is 9 years later. If I have to relive this part of my journey, how do I make it bigger than me? Because if it took 9 years for me to get this phone call, I can only imagine how much longer it's taken other people. And so at that time, I didn't know nothing about the backlog. So here in the United States of America, we have a backlog of untested rape kits throughout the whole 50 states. So literally it's over 100,000 untested kits in the United States. And so
what does that process look like? Like, what do you mean?
So basically, in a nutshell, throughout the U.S., we've had people that have gotten their rape kit done and it's been shelved in a warehouse somewhere. Law enforcement didn't send it to the crime lab to process it to determine whether or not, a rape actually happened, but also two, if there's a perpetrator that needs to be locked up. So an investigation needs to happen. And so when I did the research and realized that there was this backlog, and I'm like, wait a minute. How does this happen? One, and two, how do I like help, you know, put my name in a hat to kind of like push this information out there? So one of my dear friends, she does a lot of work in Detroit, Michigan, around gun violence. And so she said to me, she said, well, Leah, start researching some of the organizations that's already doing the work and see how you can partner with them. So I did. And I ended up partnering with our Federal Coalition Against Sexual Assault here in Maryland, where I live. And we just started doing the work. Like, they brought me on as a community partner, and I was able to like talk to law enforcement and train them about the importance of, you know, not only helping survivors through the process by providing that information that they need, but the importance of like offering an apology. You know, you'll be surprised how law enforcement here in the U.S. does not want to apologize for anything. Like, they don't think they're wrong.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. They don't think they're wrong for anything. So, and then it went from me training law enforcement to then being able to have conversations with the attorney generals and talk to them about the work, you know, the importance of, again, partnering with survivors of sexual assault. And now, actually tomorrow, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, I'll be going to the White House and being able to sit with legislators and politicians about this work. And so I just knew that if God was going to allow something that I had worked through to come back 9 years later, I knew it had to be bigger than me. And so I was just like, all right, God, I'm just going to be a vessel. Wherever this leads me, we're going to go, you know, to really share my experience. But also, it's nothing like a survivor being able to really share what's really going on. You know, like, a lot of organizations, they have like statistics and data and all that, and that's important too, but it's nothing like somebody that's actually lived through it to really be able to share from their perspective what's really happening. And so I always tell people, my opinion is, if God has allowed you to go through something and you've survived it, then you kind of have an obligation to go back and help somebody else. And so that's what I do. Like, my work is being able to help other people that have gone through it, who may not, you know, have the strength and the courage to speak up yet. Let them know, like, you have someone fighting on your behalf, because I've been where you've been.
Wow, that's really beautiful. And I mean, I've said it before, but I truly admire your story, admire you, and how and what you've done with the cards that life has dealt you. Not everyone is able to do that, and which is why it's a great thing that you can spread this message, because some people just need to hear it. For a lot of people, they're stuck at that point where they're judging themselves and feeling like, okay, all this happened because it was my fault. I must have done something wrong. I don't deserve a good life anymore. And just hearing someone say, I went through this and it's okay, and you can actually get going again. It's all right to live a good life. You deserve a good life. That's the point at which a lot of people are stuck. They just feel like they do not deserve a good life. And once you think like that, you can't work on anything, really. You can't work on yourself, because why would you want to work on yourself if you're not even worth it to begin with? So that's why I truly think you've done a phenomenal job.
Thank
And
you.
yeah, we've gone for quite some time now, and I think I've covered most of the questions I really wanted to ask, those things that I felt people would really love to hear from you. But if there's anything you feel you want to share with the audience, that would be a great idea. So you can just tell us what is the key message you would want the audience to hear, what you want them to know about themselves or about you, and how they can connect with you, connect with the work you're doing. Although I'm going to include the links to all your, well, as many of your platforms as I can, but it's still good to hear you say that so people can, connect with it easier.
Yeah, so I always tell people you can pretty much find me on every social media platform as Leah M40. I'm on all the major platforms. I do have a Facebook community. It's called Pitch Like a Boss. So it's for women and entrepreneurs who really desire to attract more media attention while increasing their profits and building their authority in their industry, which is what I teach and what I do. I've been doing it for 6 years now. So definitely come to kick it with us on the in the community. I always say you can always email me at info@LeahM40 if you have any questions, want to know what I got going on. Definitely shoot me an email. And then I would say probably the message I want to leave with people is turn your pain into power. Like, regardless of what you have been through, there is someone somewhere that is feeling stuck because they've been through something similar, and they're just waiting for you to be the messenger to say that you can overcome it and that you can come out of it. And so that's what I would leave with the people. Turn your pain into power. Like, don't let what you've been through defeat you. Like, snatch your power back and really create the life and business that you desire to create.
Amazing. That's a great message. So, guys, I am sure that you've been inspired by Leah, such a wonderful person, and I have been. And please reach out to her if you're going through anything similar or you've gone through something similar. Leah's the person to meet, and you can just join one of her groups, check out her content. Please get her books, and I'm sure that's a good place to start. Hey there. Thank you for watching or listening to this episode. I'm sure you were inspired by my guest. Please do not forget to like, comment, and share. And if you are yet to subscribe, please do subscribe. It's going to help me improve the quality of the content I bring to you each time. I wish you all the best. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye!